This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, how will federal Labor resolve the growing internal divisions over the government's tax bill? We speak with the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese. And a very British scandal. Will Boris Johnson's home life derail his bid to become PM?
Most people would really rather judge my ambitions and my character and my programme.
They want to know why the police were called to your house in the early hours of Friday morning.
I think people have... I don't think they want to hear about that kind of thing.
Well, I'm saying that it is cowardice.
The United States has announced direct sanctions against Iran's supreme leader as part of what it calls a maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian regime. The US is also calling for more countries to take measures against Iran, sending senior officials to the Middle East to build support for its approach. Iran is remaining defiant, but its people say the sanctions are starting to hurt. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchik reports from the United Arab Emirates.
Donald Trump might have pulled back from military action, but he's increasing US pressure in other ways, such as new sanctions against the Iranian leadership.
Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the supreme leader and the supreme leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support. The assets of Ayatollah Khomeini and his office will not be spared from the sanctions.
The U.S. has sent senior officials to the Middle East to build support for further measures against Iran. Its plan is to isolate Iran diplomatically, cripple it economically, then force it to submit to broader restrictions on its nuclear program, regional ambitions, and weapons development.
We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran until the regime abandons its dangerous activities and aspirations, including the pursuit of nuclear weapons, increased enrichment of uranium, development of ballistic missiles, engagement in and support for terrorism, fueling of foreign conflicts, and belligerent acts directed against the United States and its allies.
The existing U.S. sanctions are already starting to bite. The U.S. says they've forced Iran to reduce its support for armed groups around the Middle East and its military budget. But the sanctions are putting increasing pressure on everyday Iranians, who say they're now struggling to get by. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin says that's not the United States' intention.
Our issue is not with the people of Iran. So I just want to be very clear. We are not looking at creating issues for the people of Iran. Having said that, we are have sanctions against bad behavior, and there's no question that locking this money up worked last time, and there's no question locking the money up works now.
Iran's government is remaining defiant. Foreign Ministry spokesman Sayed Abbas Mousavi says Iran has withstood American pressure for decades. Is there any sanction left for America to impose that has not been imposed on us recently or in the last 40 years, he says? And is there anything they have gained from this? Mr. Mousavi says that unless European nations help relieve the US sanctions, Iran will soon breach its commitments under a key nuclear control agreement later this week. There are a few days left and they know what they need to do, he says. If we see that nothing is done, we will proceed with our second step. That's Iran's way of applying maximum pressure. From the United Arab Emirates, this is Eric Torchek reporting for AM.
Economic growth slowing and unusually, both sides of politics agree income tax cuts could help stimulate the economy by putting more money back in people's wallets, hoping they spend it. But agreement on the precise form of cuts is proving elusive, and so too is a deal to pass them through the federal parliament when it resumes next week. Labor's now offered to pass the first two stages of the government's three-part tax cut package, but the coalition is adamant it wants the entire plan passed. Here's political reporter Tommy Gilden.
The troublesome third stage of the government's tax cut plan remains the stumbling block in negotiations, and the government's rejected Labor's latest plan to pass the first two stages alone. Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers.
Our priority is to get it split out, to get one and two passed, to get three deferred, We'll have a subsequent conversation about three at a later date.
And there seems to be plenty more room for negotiation before Parliament resumes.
We've still got another week or so until this comes before the Parliament, a week or more. So there'll be lots of back and forth, no doubt.
That'll be happening against a backdrop of an increasingly gloomy economic picture. Acting Treasurer Simon Birmingham spoke to 7:30 last night.
The rate of growth around global trade is down on what we had expected previously. That has in turn seen the OECD and IMF revise down some of the global economic growth forecasts.
Jim Chalmers is no less pessimistic.
We've got stagnant wages, weak consumption, weak business conditions, weak consumer confidence. And so we want to play a role in helping to turn that around.
And he says tax cuts are a good way to do just that.
The economy desperately needs that help. And the government shouldn't hold that assistance that the economy needs and that workers need, shouldn't hold that hostage.
Well, they'd argue it's you holding it hostage.
Well, I know they would, Tom, but that doesn't make it true, does it?
Simon Birmingham says the government took all three stages to the election.
It's only 5 weeks since we had an election, and tax was at the heart of that election.
And he's got a beef with Labor's main objection to stage three, that it doesn't come in until 2024, and that it costs the budget almost $100 billion.
When we deliver social policies like the NDIS and ensuring it's fully funded and getting record numbers of Australians onto the NDIS, that's a long-term proposition. In fixing our income tax system to make sure the incentives to work are right, that should also be a long-term proposition. Governments should be able to make decisions that aren't just 1 or 2 years into the future, but actually look to the long term.
The government, in their arrogance, wants to pretend that they won two elections in one night, 5 weeks ago. They have a mandate for the term of parliament that followed their election win. They don't have a mandate for every subsequent election after that.
But to stop you there, Labor went down exactly this route, for example, with the NDIS. It went out 10 years as well. So what is the problem with the government adopting exactly the same strategy?
No, it's completely different, Tom, and I'm so pleased that you asked me because it's entirely different. The difference is when we were proposing programs, they were to begin in the subsequent term of Parliament. What the government is proposing here is to have quite substantial, quite expensive tax changes come in, not after the election that they've won, but the election after that.
And that is the Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, ending that report by Tom Eagledon and the Opposition Leader, Anthony Albanese, joined me a short time ago. Mr Albanese, thanks for joining AM.
Thanks for having me on the program.
The Prime Minister says the Senate will sit without a break until the three-part tax package is passed. What's your response?
Well, Mr Morrison has a choice between an outcome and an argument. We've put forward a proposition that would see immediate tax cuts pass faster, higher tax cuts for every single worker in the economy. And we can do that in one day. We've promised to expedite the package. But Mr Morrison just wants an argument rather than an outcome, more conflict, more of what the country doesn't need.
But he argues that Labor is being fiscally reckless here, that the Coalition will deliver an election promise where this policy was central to its campaign.
Well, the fact is that stage one was central to its campaign, that tax cuts would be passed by July 1. Mr Morrison has broken that commitment that he made. What the difference is here is over whether the economy needs additional stimulus, and that's why we want to bring forward the part of stage two of the tax cuts that would increase the threshold from $90,000 to $120,000 for 37%. And that would provide up to $1,350 to all those who earn above $90,000 and have a real stimulus effect on the economy. And that's precisely what's needed right now.
The government seems increasingly confident that it will get its entire package passed with crossbench support. Is Labor about to become irrelevant to a key federal debate?
Well, we've been discussing with the crossbench our proposals as well, and we'll continue to do that. But what we're doing is putting the national economic interest first. We want to see a positive outcome. We want to get that economic activity occurring. The fact is the economy is struggling. We have very low growth. We have wages that are not keeping up with the cost of living. We have a doubling of the debt under this government's watch. We have dampening consumer demand, and the government is acting like, once again, like an opposition and just looking for more conflict, when the opposition is actually being constructive and offering a path forward.
Look, Matthias Cormann is actually accusing you of trying to govern from opposition. If the legislation passes with the three tranches, will you go to the next election promising to repeal that top tranche?
We'll make our commitments for the next election before the next election.
Some of your colleagues, notably senior frontbencher Joel Fitzgibbon, says Labor should pass the entire package, that you can't afford to give the government an opportunity to blame Labor if the economy turns sour. Is he wrong?
What we're doing here is offering to assist the economy. We know that the economy is slowing, and we know that stimulus is needed right now. The Reserve Bank of Australia indicated that when they decreased interest rates since the election and are talking of another further rate cut down the track from the already levels that are at very low levels. So the fact is that we are being constructive. We're offering to pass the first stage of the tax cuts, but to bring forward the second stage so that all workers will get a tax cut. Under the government's proposition, all workers won't get a tax cut in this term. That's their idea. What we're saying is that more is needed, as well as a bring forward of some of the infrastructure investment.
Mr. Morrison's also flagged he wants change unknown in scope and size on IR and scrapping red tape, particularly on development projects. How will you assess whatever policy he puts forward?
Well, that's exactly the point, isn't it? There is no policy being put forward. What there is just a little bit of anti-union rhetoric, as usual, from the government, and a statement about red tape. I thought that they solved the red tape issue during their first two terms of government, when we had whole days of parliament devoted to getting red tape that mainly consisted of moving commas and adding words like and into legislation, or removing particular paragraphs that had been duplicated. The fact is that this government is in search of an agenda, and that's why Labor's been constructive and putting forward an agenda that would actually assist the economy.
Just on the unions, the CFMEU solidarity with John Setker has given the government a free kick against Labor and the union movement, hasn't it?
Well, we've taken a strong stance as Labor leader. I've said that I will move for the expulsion of John Setker when the National Executive meets on July the 5th. We've suspended his membership of the party, and that is in the party's interest that he no longer remain a member.
The CFMEU is standing by Mr. Setker, and so are a number of other unions. Are they out of step with the public?
Look, it's up to the union movement to determine its own position. What it's up to me to do is to put forward propositions that are in the best interest of the Labor Party. It's not in the interest of the Labor Party that Mr. Setker remain a member.
Mr. Albanese, thanks for talking to AM.
Thanks very much.
And that is the Federal Opposition Leader, Anthony Albanese. The consumer watchdog has confirmed it's investigating Telstra over the way it sells phone contracts to vulnerable Indigenous Australians. AM can reveal the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission is investigating serious allegations raised by financial counsellors working in rural and remote areas who claim Telstra is selling expensive mobile phone plans to people living on welfare. Consumer advocates are now calling for Telstra to be subject to the same rules as banks, allowing proper checks to assess if potential customers can afford a phone contract. Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge has this story from Broome in Western Australia.
Whee! On a warm afternoon in Broome, young mum Caitlin Rowe enjoys precious moments with her two-year-old daughter, Kailani. Caitlin lives on welfare. Making life harder, she spent last year battling a crippling Telstra bill of almost $2,200.
So it was pretty difficult at that time because I was struggling with some other stuff as well, like trying to feed my daughter and things.
Caitlin was a long-time prepaid Telstra customer when she says she was offered a phone if she took out a two-year contract.
But they did not tell me that if I used the data more, it was going to get higher and higher, which I didn't know about.
Then she received a notice from debt collectors threatening legal action if she didn't pay.
That was scary because, you know, 21-year-old mother, I was a bit shocked, you know, and I was stressing out.
Broome financial counsellor Alan Gray sees dozens of cases like Caitlin's as he drives across the Kimberley visiting clients.
What's happening time and time again is that my clients don't have it explained to them that on top of the monthly contract fee, this is how excess data works. People are very embarrassed about their debts. They blame themselves.
Last year, Alan Gray was able to get more than $100,000 worth of Telstra debt waived for 26 customers, some with bills as high as $9,000. But Mr. Gray says he and other financial counsellors continue to deal with protracted disputes with Telstra on behalf of their vulnerable clients.
I had no idea that this problem was bigger than Broome. And then I just bumped into someone from Alice Springs, another financial counsellor, and we started a little network, and before long we discovered that this exactly the same practices were happening in Broome, in Alice Springs, in the APY lands, in Darwin, in Cairns. It's happening all over the outback.
The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has now confirmed it's investigating Telstra's conduct. Consumer and Small Business Executive at Telstra, Michael Ackland, says the company has been changing its systems to do better.
Vulnerable customers and customers in all forms of vulnerability is something that we are very aware of and constantly looking to improve how we get that right. And it's in fact in our interest and the customer's interest to get that right. That said, we will not always get it right.
Caitlin Rowe eventually had her debt waived with the help of local financial counsellors. Telstra has apologised unreservedly to Ms. Rowe and says mistakes were made in her case.
Amy Bainbridge reporting there. News Corp Australia says a court ruling that media companies are responsible for Facebook users' comments on their posts defies belief. The New South Wales Supreme Court has made the ruling in a defamation case brought by the former Northern Territory youth detainee Dylan Voller. His lawyers say the verdict promotes a more responsible approach by media organisations, but media companies are considering appealing, with News Corp saying it shows how out of sync Australia's defamation laws are with other English-speaking democracies. Lexi Metherill reports.
The decision threatens to make traditional media's use of Facebook more complicated and expensive. Paul Gordon is a social media lawyer at Wallman's Lawyers.
Look, I think that if this decision stands, then it will have significant ripples through the media landscape.
The New South Wales Supreme Court has found media organisations are responsible for defamatory comments made by others on their public Facebook pages.
It is highly likely that media organisations will have to look very carefully at their moderation teams. They're going to have to proactively hide posts before comments are allowed to be seen by the public. They're going to need to have rapid turnaround in terms of defamatory content.
The ruling has been made in a defamation case brought by the former Northern Territory youth detainee Dylan Voller. He's suing three media organisations over what he says were defamatory comments made by third parties on their Facebook pages. Michael Douglas is a senior lecturer at the University of Western Australia's Law School.
Media companies have a commercial interest in people commenting on links to news stories. And that commercial interest was one of the premises from which the judge reasoned that, well, these media companies ought to be maintaining their Facebook pages. They should be devoting resources to make sure that basically dodgy and defamatory stuff is taken down.
One of the defendants, News Corp Australia, has indicated it's likely to appeal, but there's no guarantee it would be successful. Lawyers say the ruling is in line with judgments in similar cases globally. Paul Gordon.
It follows a line of authority that's been developing for a while, but it does go a little bit further than we've previously seen. The key difference here is that the judge has basically said, well, if media companies want to get the commercial benefit of using social media, they have to accept with it that it comes with a risk.
News Corp says it's ridiculous that Facebook bears no responsibility, despite not allowing media companies to turn off comments. But Dylan Voller's lawyer, Peter O'Brien, says there are ways of filtering them.
On the evidence before the court, each of the defendants here, media outlets, had the means to effectively delay the publication of the third-party comments and to monitor whether they were in fact defamatory before releasing them to the general readership.
Another defendant, the Sydney Morning Herald, says it's considering its options and the implications of the ruling. Facebook has declined to comment.
Lexi Metherill reporting. As you head into work this morning, the possibility of ending the day with a work-related injury is probably the last thing on your mind. But every year, more than 500,000 Australians are hurt or become ill while doing their jobs, and many end up in a drawn-out fight for compensation. Now, one traumatised police officer is taking the law into her own hands, launching a private criminal prosecution against one of Australia's biggest workers' compensation companies over its handling of her claim. Pat McGrath reports.
Unions and employers don't agree on much, but when it comes to workers' compensation in New South Wales right now, they're on the same page.
The system doesn't deliver for employers and it doesn't deliver for workers.
Unions New South Wales Secretary Mark Morey says years of tinkering with the system has left workers worse off.
It's been very geared to challenging workers, injured workers, about their claims, dragging them out.
One big change over the past 2 years has been the outsourcing of almost all claims management to a single workers' compensation company, Employers Mutual Limited, or EML.
We are EML, Employees Mutual Limited.
The arrangement's gotten off to a rocky start, with employer groups complaining that they're struggling to even get EML staff on the phone. And now one injured worker has gotten sick of waiting and is taking unprecedented action against EML. Former Newcastle police officer Julie Heiss developed post-traumatic stress disorder after being trapped inside her squad car after a rollover in 2009. And lodged a compensation claim almost a decade later. But it took EML almost a year to determine her claim, and under New South Wales law, failing to decide on a claim within 2 months is a criminal offence. Now, Julie Heiss is dragging EML before the criminal courts in an extremely rare private prosecution, a move New South Wales Greens MP and former barrister David Shoebridge says is extraordinary.
For the last 100 years, we would have seen just a handful of private prosecutions being commenced. This is the first time I've seen a private prosecution launched against an insurance company.
EML has declined to comment or respond to questions because the matter is before the courts. The State Insurance Regulatory Authority says while it's never prosecuted a WorkCover company for criminal breaches, it has issued warnings and penalty notices. Outsourcing of claims management is increasing across the country. David Shoebridge believes the entire model needs to be overhauled.
Once the dealings between the injured worker and the statutory fund have been outsourced to a corporate insurer like EML, the remuneration that's paid to the insurer tends to be based on how much they handle the claim. And what that can sometimes lead to is cases being endlessly processed, because every time that happens, the insurer gets paid.
The state regulator says it's happy to meet Julie Heiss and discuss her case. But for now, she's getting ready for her day in court.
Pat McGrath with that report. The Health Star rating on food is a great tool for parents who want to make sure their kids aren't eating too much sugar or fat, but it may also be seriously inaccurate, and giving shoppers a false sense of security about what they're eating. The consumer advocacy group Choice says the scheme needs an overhaul and that popular brands of cereal, health bars and energy drinks contain more sugar than the ratings suggest. Gavin Coote reports.
It's designed to give consumers an at-a-glance score just by looking at the front of the packet. In an era of processed and packaged foods aplenty, the Health Star rating system informs millions of Australians about the nutrition of a product they're about to sink their teeth into without having to study the nutritional information table on the side or the back of the box. The food ratings range from half a star to five. Items are penalised for the amount of salt, sugar and saturated fat, while gaining stars for fruit and vegetable content or the amount of protein and fibre. But not everyone's happy with the way these ratings are decided.
Right now, we have a major opportunity to improve the health star rating system and make sure that Australia stays ahead of the curve in terms of our front of pack labelling system.
Linda Przedetsky is from the country's largest consumer advocacy group, Choice. It's urging for a major shake-up of the way the health star rating is calculated, arguing added sugars that are not naturally found in foods aren't taken into account.
Not all sugars are created equal. Added sugars are extra sugars which are added into packaged products during the manufacturing process. These are the ones that the World Health Organization recommends that we cut down on.
Using an alternative algorithm which penalises added sugar, Linda Przedetsky says it's cereals in particular where star ratings could look completely different.
Some of the findings from our work really surprised us because we found that some products could actually lose as much as 2.5 health stars.
Using this measure, cereals like Nutrigrain, Uncle Toby's Plus Protein and Milo would plummet from 4 out of 5 stars to just 1.5 stars. The federal government's already reviewing the health star rating system, and states and territories are soon expected to meet with the Commonwealth to discuss the report's final recommendations. Michael Moore is a distinguished fellow at the George Institute and helped design the original system. He agrees added sugar needs to be factored in.
And we know that Nutrigrain had four stars, but originally it had a much lower rating than that until the company added fibre, added protein, removed quite a bit of sugar. And that's actually what brought it up.
He says the reformulation of products like Nutrigrain shows the system is complex.
So this is an opportunity to improve a system that's working quite well, but not well enough.
In a statement, the Australian Food and Grocery Council says the amount of total sugar is accounted for in the existing algorithm.
Gavin Coote reporting. In the UK, the frontrunner for the Tory leadership, Boris Johnson, has been labelled a coward as the race becomes increasingly personal. Mr Johnson has refused to answer questions about a late-night row with his girlfriend, which prompted a visit from police. His opponent, the Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, says the former London mayor wants to slink through the back door of Downing Street. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley filed this report.
Does a person's private life have any bearing on their ability to do the hustings,
Boris Johnson was just not going there.
They want to know why the police were called to your house in the early hours of Friday morning.
I don't think they want to hear about that kind of thing. Unless I'm wrong. I think.
The crowd was sympathetic, but critics argue as he runs for high office, his character must be open to scrutiny. While the row with his partner, Carrie Simmons, and the late-night visit by police continues to dominate the headlines, Mr Johnson is barely anywhere to be seen. A television debate between the leadership hopefuls scheduled for Tuesday evening London time has been cancelled by Sky, after Mr Johnson refused to appear.
I just think it's very disrespectful to Conservative Party members.
In a newspaper article, the Foreign Secretary and leadership hopeful Jeremy Hunt went further, declaring Mr Johnson a coward who's pathetically evading questions, demanding he man up.
Well, I'm saying that it is cowardice, frankly, not to appear in head-to-head debates against me.
But Boris Johnson's past indiscretions haven't hurt his political rise yet. The former Australian Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, who's the executive chair of the International School of Government at London's King's College, says you either like him or hate him, with nothing much in between.
I think it depends very much on who you talk to. Like all politicians, he has his enemies and his friends. I mean, he's what in England they call a Marmite politician, Marmite being like Vegemite. You either love it or you hate it.
For now, it's a very personal battle, but at its centre is Brexit. Boris Johnson has promised to take the UK out of the EU on October the 31st with or without a deal. Jeremy Hunt remains open to a further extension. The opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has told the House of Commons neither candidate knows how to resolve the Brexit impasse.
Given the shambolic no-deal preparations so far, which were paused in the spring, can the Prime Minister confirm that the government will not be ready to crash out in October?
If Boris Johnson is successful, he'll have to battle with the Brexit chaos that's gripped the Conservative Party.
Most people would really rather judge my ambitions and my character and my programme by what I deliver.
No, what they want to know is...
And regardless of what goes on behind closed doors, that will be a far greater task. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell. And today on The Signal, we're going inside the wellness crystal trade.
Yeah, so there's a crystal boom on at the moment, but tracing their source is a different story. Plenty of crystals are mined unethically, using child labour or damaging the environment, and it's almost impossible to know which ones to trust.
Today on The Signal, we go deep on the crystal trade, from the shop front...
You are holding a piece of Mars.
Really?
What?
All the way back up the supply chain.
That's The Signal. You can hear us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you usually find podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.